Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening. We're very pleased this week to be joined by Yohai Gall, Boston Tech Collective. Yohai, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And so you, as I mentioned, are with the Boston Tech Collective. Now, I understand from reading your site, you were you actually started the San Francisco Tech Collective back in 2007, and then you moved to Boston, five or so years ago, something like that?
2011.
And so you have some, you know, pretty decent experience there with running tech-focused co-ops. And I understand you're also interested in worker-owned cooperative business structure in general. So I definitely want to talk a little bit about that because it's fairly unique. Do you know of any others in the ACN community?
Not that are specific to like Apple, for example, but that do cover Apple as far as their service platform is concerned. The main company that I would think of is C4 Tech in New Orleans. They do PC, Mac, and Linux support as well as web development and design. And they're, I think, the first worker-owned IT services consultancy, repair shop, etc., in the U.S. We were the second, I think. There are quite a few like web co-ops, but in terms of providing services and support, 10 at the most now nationally.
So what was so appealing about that business model when you founded the San Francisco Tech Collective in 2007?
For starters, I had worked both independently and for various companies and MSPs and such doing support for small businesses and homes and then later more enterprisey stuff. And my experience sort of taught me that while most of the time the job itself is pretty good, you know, the actual work is good, the structure of the business, whether it's a top-down hierarchy with one owner or whether you have a board or whatever, usually wasn't copacetic to not just the way that I work, but the way that a lot of techs work, sort of freewheeling, creative, thinking outside of the box, those kind of helpful tools doing what we do clash against how many businesses are structured, specifically in the tech field, I found, since there are quite a few that are sort of started by someone with no business experience, like myself, who either got lucky or worked really hard and then built themselves up, but don't really know how to not just manage the business, but also work with other people. And there's a lot of sort of what I consider social difficulties in the tech field. You guys probably have never heard that. A big way of dealing with that is to have a structure in which people are engendered to become responsible for not only their specific tasks, but the business itself. So to be more specific, giving our technicians the opportunity to make decisions about the business and to take responsibility and act as a business owner, it helps shape the business in such a way that it not only provides what I consider to be superior customer service and support, but also it creates a better working environment. That's sort of my roundabout way of saying it's a more copacetic working environment for people like myself and many others in the IT field, who, by the way, already work fairly democratically all the time. I mean, the entire open source community is devised around similar structures, and collaboration, even in proprietary outfits, are still fairly horizontal in how people interact with one another. I would actually argue that classic IT nerd probably is more open to dealing with people based on their merits and on their skills rather than some arbitrary hierarchy like you'd find at many large companies. Just that's my personal experience.
I certainly think it presents an interesting scenario for the people you bring into the fold. So my question, when you bring someone in or someone joins, and that's another question of how they do, is it that you're automatically brought into the ownership model, or can you be just an employee if you so choose?
I can speak personally, but I can't speak on how every co-op functions because they, quite frankly, all are not the same. They very much depend on how they were formed and the bylaws that they were built around, as well as the state they're in. In my company specifically, our bylaws, which by the way are Creative Commons licensed and can be found on our website, they stipulate very specifically the both the status of a member as well as the process for how a employee becomes a member. To answer your actual question, we have a trial period of 1 year after a person joins the company as a part-time or full-time employee. Part-time employees, there's a specific process to deal with them, but let's put them aside for a second. Full-time employees have a full year of working before they are even considered for membership, at which point they have to be voted in unanimously by the rest of the company. Aside from that, our company in particular does not allow employees who are not members. So if you're not voted in after a year and we don't have some special consideration made for you, you're just going to get fired. And that actually happened not that long ago. Last summer, we fired a guy who was with us for a year and just couldn't cut it skill-wise, but was great in every other capacity, and we just couldn't make it work with him. And we had to let him go fairly amicably, honestly, but it wasn't that wouldn't want to keep him as an employee. We literally can't. It's our articles of incorporation say we only have one class of membership, and that's the owners. You can't actually have employees. You can only have trial members and members. And that's how we work. There are worker cooperatives in other fields, like I don't know if they have this bread out where you guys are, but there's a Alvarado Street Baking Company. They have a cat on their bread. Anyways, they're a pretty big co-op. They have like 400 members or 400 employees, but they have a completely optional membership program that every employee can apply for. And if they are accepted, which there's no reason why they wouldn't be, they have to go to meetings and they have to vote and all that kind of stuff. But if they don't want to, they just don't apply and they're regular employees. And that's an example of how different the model can be. It just depends on honestly how the founders or the owners made the cooperative structure and how they built it into the bylaws of the business.
So in your case, in the example you gave, because you couldn't reach sort of a consensus vote to vote this provisional worker in as a member of the co-op, therefore you had to fire the person.
Correct. The other option would be we could give him an extension once, basically. But and I've seen places do that. But I got to say, if by a year they don't vote you in, it's probably not going to happen. Right. And I should say, in this case, it was a unanimous, we should fire him. It's a great example to bring up because this is a guy who was very good at being, he had great social skills, pretty good at some parts of his job, but he just wasn't really growing quickly enough. And we were trying really hard to train him as part of his trial period. We were giving him as many skills as we could in certain areas and trying to sort of teach him how to be an owner. And in some places he was doing really well, but from a business perspective, we had to make a decision. Like this guy has cost us $80,000 so far. He's made us some money, but a lot of the times it's been messy and he's not really improving. And it's been a year and we've had multiple meetings with him. And at this point, we just need to find someone who can do the job because we're a business. And that's what makes the worker cooperative model unique, is that you occasionally have to be mean. You have to be a boss and you have to make difficult decisions. And people don't like to do that. So you need to teach them that in order for the business to function. And if it doesn't, then the business sinks. And in my opinion, that's for the best. You know, people always say to me like, well, what happens if someone decides to be lazy? And I say, well, assuming that the other people in the business didn't tell him to stop or her to stop and the business just continued on, then the business would suffer. And maybe that's a good thing. So that's sort of, I'm going into that territory because a lot of people have a very obvious question, I think, which is, what do you do when people are being lazy? You know, if they're an owner, how do you stop them from doing something wrong, not being a good worker? Well, we have systems in place for that, and obviously those can change, but we make it fairly difficult to change, and it has to be done by the members themselves. So, to me, that's a nice balance approach to how businesses can function.
And with the way you guys are set up, obviously become an owner after a year if approved, but you're also still very much in the, let's say, technology side of things. So, you know, like in a typical scenario, let's say that you work for a particular company for a certain amount of time, and then you move up perhaps to management where you manage employees and you do other things. But with this sort of cooperative that you guys have, is everyone still very much involved in the technological aspect of things, or do you go up to a management sort of level where that doesn't happen anymore?
I mean, that's a great question. The only people who don't directly deal with technology is, you know, admin staff, operations, people like that. Like we have a full-time operations manager who has no tech knowledge, but is great at her job, you know, doesn't fix computers. As far as people who start in the tech field, like myself, I used to be a field tech. So I would go to client sites all day, every day. now I have graduated to being a manager. My pay rate is different than other people. I have more responsibilities and I get to make certain final decisions as part of the department that I'm in. I do actually more tech stuff than I did before because now it's not just a break fix or MSP response scenario. Now I'm in DevOps. You know, now I manage 10 servers and I get to trial new pieces of software and I get to do a lot more research. And my job is actually a lot more tech focused than it was when I was simply doing field tech work. So that's my specific area of expertise. But another example would be we have a guy who started doing shop work, but his background was in computer science. He came in with a degree in computer science, but we didn't have a web development department at the time. We just didn't do web dev. He had the skills, but we just, you know, it wasn't something we were ready to do. And since a lot of our business is based around what we can do, it wasn't an option. He worked in our shop for about 2 years. And our shop is basically, you know, if you have a iMac that needs a hard drive replaced, or if you need data recovery, or the million other things that they do in there, it's very much focused in the opposite direction of web development. Well, after a time, he trained someone to replace him, and then we gave him the opportunity to try out doing a web development business within our own existing business. And it took him about 4 months of part-time work to build it up. And now he's full-time our web developer, and he makes a good money. He makes much more than he did before, and he also brings in a lot more than he did before. And that's what he does full time. And he's our web developer, our in-house web dev. He graduated, I would say, from a sort of lower tech area to a higher tech area. And while he's not a manager, he does run his department. And when he hires on a second person, he probably will be a manager for that department. So to answer your question, we still say technical, and we have a sort of platform for growth and skill development within the business. We don't want to keep you at one place. People are always moving up and being replaced. And with that, the business can grow.
So the moving up part, how does that actually work? You described these two different transitions, you know, in yourself, as you mentioned, you sort of graduated or progressed into this managerial role, and then the, you know, tech moving toward web development. Who's sort of like overseeing this? Do these things get voted in? Who elects you to be a manager?
I was elected to be a manager within my department basically by suggesting at one of our general management meeting or general membership meetings, which we have once a month. I should back up a little bit. We have a all hands meeting, including non-owners, every month. And we also have weekly departmental meetings. So whether you're in the shop or whether you're in business support, whatever, we have departmental meetings. I suggested this idea at one of our departmental meetings and then took it to the GMM. The next GMM and said, here's the plan. Here's how we're going to pay for it. Here's why it's needed, et cetera. And then they all just agreed to let me do it. We actually only have votes when there's disagreement. One thing I wanted to mention earlier, we're a worker cooperative. There's actually no such thing as a collective on a technical level, on a legal level. There's no legal framework for collectives. On the philosophical side, there is a difference between a collective and a cooperative. Typically, a collective is a consensus-based company, organization. It basically means that you have to all agree for something to happen. To me, I think that's completely crazy. So we are a cooperative both in structure as well as in principle. We use majority vote to make decisions, not consensus. I just wanted to point that out because people get confused by it a lot. As far as answering your last question, we have to tell other people that we have an idea and we want to do it before we do it. That's sort of the policy that we have. It's not like written anywhere. We do have plenty of policies, but it's sort of understood that when you're an owner, you're empowered to pretty much do whatever you want within the auspices of the other members' unspoken or spoken policies. So I, for example, know that I can't just go spend our Amex gold card to buy $10,000 worth of equipment. I can't do that. We have a specific policy that prevents me from doing that. And if I did do that, well, that would be, you know, means for termination and they could all vote me out of the company. And by the way, that is how we work, is to remove a member. You just have to have a majority vote of the owners and the member's gone. And member and owner are interchangeable. But so there's existing policies that I'm aware of that prevent me or allow me to do certain things. And then there are unspoken policies like, hey, when you leave for the day, turn the lights off because it costs us money. And if it costs us money, it hurts your paycheck in the end on some level. So avoid doing that. And that's sort of the unspoken agreements that we all have. And when I suggested that they make me a manager, it wasn't like, hey, guys, can we vote on this? It was, hey, we really need this and you guys trust me and we're all owners here. So I think we should do it. And then the finance person says, okay, well, we have the money to do it, or I see how we will have the money to do it, so it's worth it. You have this much time to try it out. And then we sort of move forward after that. In some ways, it's very procedural. In other ways, it's just sort of an ephemeral understanding that we all have with each other that obviously wouldn't work in a really large company. I think the larger co-ops have much more structure than co-ops of our size, which, by the way, we have 7 full-time members. 5 of them are owners at the moment, just to explain how we're structured. And then San Francisco has now they have 4 full-time members. They actually have sort of gone down over the years to a core group of people.
Do you have any insight into how an organization like yours evolves one direction or the other, getting larger or scaling back?
It's interesting because for them, they are paid more than we are on average. They just found a niche and decided they were comfortable at their level. And I'm sure they could hire now and expand, but I think they're happy with their... Well, for one thing, they're overworked. Like San Francisco has so much work after being there for so long and having what's now a trademark name because it's common knowledge that Tech Collective means this IT company and not whatever else it meant before. So they've been around for so long that people just always go to them. All the startups go to them. They're very well liked by on Yelp, for instance. They have something like 300 5-star reviews. So they're very well liked. And I'm happy to say I was part of that for 5 years before coming here. They're also entirely autonomous. So I can't speak completely on their decision-making structure. We do have a very tight connection, so I do hear a lot of their opinions, but my impression is that they're happy where they are, and they'll expand when they feel like they need to, but as far as how things are currently structured, they found a service model that works for them. I mean, they used to have a shop like we do, and then they voted to close the shop. They just decided we don't want to do it anymore. And now they are, in my understanding, they're in a better place, and they are happier overall, so... more power to them. On the other hand, we really like our shop and we think it's a big part of the neighborhood that we're in, and we're super happy about it and it brings in business, but maybe one day we'll have a similar conversation. I can tell you that in terms of growth, for us, it's always been intentional. It's like, okay, for instance, I sell laptops to customers now. We did not sell machines, laptops or desktops at all, ever before. We just didn't want to do it. It was like a hassle and we kind of felt sort of skeezy for selling to customers things that they could easily find online for cheaper, et cetera, et cetera. Until we got to the point that so many of our partners would just drop the ball on us, that we wanted, we felt a need to control the flow of hardware to our various clients. And I did some research and we teamed up with San Francisco, and we now have a partner that we work with that gives us the opportunity to better provide hardware to our customers and also makes us quite a bit of money, and the customer is not getting screwed over and everyone's happy. And that all happened just because I decided it was important and I brought it up at a meeting and everyone agreed it was important and that I should look into it. And then we did it. And to us, that was a pretty major growth point because it doubled or tripled our hardware sales per month. And it would never have happened had we not simply discussed it and then tried it. And I think that's one of the strengths of the cooperative model, is that when you become an owner, you really do feel sort of a natural inclination to improve the business all the time. You're always looking for ways to either make your actual work better for yourself and for your coworkers, or to just improve the business and make more money. And, so many of the projects that we've had over the years have come from a technician, usually not myself, some technician saying, hey, this would be a much cooler thing to do. Let's try that out. Can I just look into this? It's going to take, a few weeks and it's going to cost us $2,000, but it'll make us money in the end, or maybe it won't, but at least we'll learn. And then we all sort of talk about it. And if it's possible, we approve it. And it's just, to me, the growth models always happen as a result of intentional actions that have been approved by one or more members in the organization.
I think that's what I find appealing about this model, is especially that, which you did hit upon, I was going to ask about, which is how they're personally invested in the organization itself. And I find that amazing because that obviously motivates everybody, because when the company does well, they do well. And this is probably the point where you haven't met Jerry, but he would tell me I'm looking at the next cool thing, because every time I see a cool business model, I'm like, ooh. But
well, I was going to ask you, Sam, is HCS a you know, co-op? I mean, it's a serious question. And not to put you on the spot, and we can certainly cut this out of the show, but is HCS a co-op in the broader sense? You've got multiple locations and you all kind of share resources, and you know, the specific vendor model reminded me of, you have a vendor you work with that's sort of like somehow in that umbrella, so to speak, and all the locations of HCS sort of share that resource. And you know, there's certain like pragmatic aspect to that as well.
Easiest answer is no. I mean, just because we're not all owners. My question also, that actually brings up, you guys fed me into each subject, so I'm happy about that. But it does bring up my question about the two different organizations. You obviously were a part of San Francisco. You came over to Boston. How do the two organizations meet? How do they work together? I mean, there's no financial investment from one owner in Boston to the side of San Francisco. So how does it come together as one organization?
Happy to answer that. Real quick, I want to mention, we actually are also members of an actual purchasing cooperative called the Tech Co-op Federation, or the TCF. You can find it at tcf.coop. We have sort of a generic landing page because we don't really try to promote it at the moment. Essentially what it is it's a group of three different worker-owned IT shops, San Francisco Tech Collective, Boston Tech Collective, and C4 Tech and Design in New Orleans, who I mentioned earlier. We together formed an actual cooperative that's made up of each of the co-ops that purchases software licenses like antivirus or hardware like SSDs and RAM from specific vendors under one name, and thus we create scale from three smaller organizations. I mean, C4 has like 14 or 15 people, SF has four, and we have seven. And together, when we go and apply to a new vendor, or when we're setting up an accounts with someone we're buying from, I can basically tell them, well, the Tech Co-op Federation is a purchasing provider of this many people and this much in business. And it's really accelerated our growth because we're able to purchase as if we were a much bigger company. And so in many ways, we're a bunch of co-ops within a larger cooperative structure that themselves are independent. But when it comes to purchasing, we actually are joined very, very tightly. And to go back to your last question, San Francisco Tech Collective is entirely independent as far as finances are concerned, but we actually have very specific services tied together that we pay for together. Our operations person does work for them, and they pay us for her to do work for them. They pay us to manage. We both use Screen Connect to do remote administration, and San Francisco pays us for that, as does C4 Tech, actually. We actually have a joined Screen Connect instance for all of our technicians that is a huge cost saver because all three companies are using it at once. And technically I'm the one managing it, but we all benefit from this, you know, massively licensed remote management software. And we also have an agreement with Watchmen to do something similar for the TCF, where all three of us get a discounted rate since we are a purchasing cooperative, since we're all members of a purchasing cooperative. But to answer your specific question about Tech Collective, we have a Google Apps domain that we are sharing together and we pay for together. We're right now going over migrating our two separate LastPass instances into one LastPass instance to see what savings are there and what kind of utility we get from sharing passwords together, because we do often do work for one another. Like if they have a particularly difficult job to do in San Francisco or vice versa, and they don't have the skills to deal with it and one of us does, or vice versa, well, we're able to do that. So for instance, I'm a Linux sysadmin by training, even though I don't usually do it for clients. If they get into a situation that is some, you know, old Red Hat distro or something and they need help, I can help them and they can pay me for that. And we have a system for allowing that to happen very easily. We also pay for our phone services together. Like we have one RingCentral account that we both companies use, and we both save money as a result. And there's plenty of other examples. So we basically share tools, and we have a system for giving control of those tools to one or two people at each location. So if, you know, they all died or something, we could still have access to our products and our online subscriptions. On a technical level, what they've done is they're incorporated in California and we're incorporated in Massachusetts. But what we're doing now is we're building an umbrella tech collective sort of concept where we're going to create, a top-level tech collective organization that is staffed by individuals at each co-op, so that when we make the next tech collective, which, I mean, it's going to happen. Like, in the next 5 years, there will be another tech collective, either because one of us is going to move somewhere or because someone's going to call me and say that they're interested in trying it out or whatever. Once we get to that point, we're going to want to form an agreement that allows them to use our name and our service model and join onto our domain and all that stuff, but also maybe has a reciprocal franchise fee or something that to make it worth our while. So long term, our plan is to create an umbrella sort of association of tech collective companies. And we're not the first to do this. There's actually a bakery in the San Francisco Bay Area called Arizmendi. That's six bakeries, each with like 20 or 30 people working there, and they are administered by one umbrella cooperative called the Association of Arizmendi Cooperatives, I think. And that umbrella cooperative is staffed by one person from each co-op to keep it equal, so to speak. And they're a massive company. I mean, they're a multi-million dollar successful bakery sort of chain in the San Francisco Bay Area that we're somewhat modeled after.
Well, speaking of bakery, the fact that this just got really meta sort of reminded me of the Kitchen of the Future from The Simpsons, where one of the new appliances of the future is a bread maker. So you guys are kind of a tech collective maker or something like that. It's pretty impressive. And I'm just going to go ahead and preemptively name this the Tech Collective Land Grab of 2017. You heard it here first, starting now. It's a pretty impressive business model, though. And I think your comment earlier about the San Francisco Tech Collective being so well established and you know, people just kind of seeking them out and just knowing of them just speaks to the fact that there's a certain aspect of this that is just appealing to people. People understand that they're probably going to get better service because, you know, as Sam mentioned, like everyone's invested in it. You know, you're sort of like your interests are aligned with the interests of the company pretty clearly.
I mean, they have to be because it's your company and people give you shit if you don't do your job. And it's not just your boss. It's everyone else because they're all empowered to also tell you you're doing a bad job. And to that point, it's not like everyone's scared all the time. People are just much more comfortable speaking their mind and telling someone when they're not acting right or when they're not doing a good job. And we have a whole system for dealing with that. And this isn't true of all co-ops, but it's pretty common. We have a system of evaluations that are quarterly where we basically rotate out a review staff that goes and looks at every single employee and tells them what they think is wrong with the work that they're doing and what they're doing well and asking them how they can help them, et cetera. And to me, it's a really effective way of getting people to be better workers and better owners. And for me, like, as you notice, I talk a lot. That's one of the major sort of complaints people have is, oh, you know, you talk over people or you don't listen, et cetera. And I'm not going to say that I've improved because I have no idea, but people have told me, oh, you know, ever since we had this quarterly evaluation and we told you need to listen more, I felt like you're listening more, et cetera. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, like, I used to think I was really good at what I do, but I've learned that, like, when it comes to being an owner, unless you really go to, like, unless you have an MBA or you've read every business book out there or done it for 20 years, it's often difficult to know what to do as an owner and how to be a good owner. And that's one of the great lessons of working in a cooperative is you learn to think like an owner, which means you learn to evaluate your coworkers and how they're doing, but not in a way that is sort of filled with aggression and powerlessness, but instead in an endearing way where you want them to succeed because if they succeed, the business succeeds. And that's what keeps coming back is no matter how many problems we've had, and it's not a perfect system, no matter how many problems we've had, there is no better place I've ever worked at. And you can ask everyone I work with, they will tell you the same thing, that they've never had a better job. And even if they got paid more somewhere else, or if they were able to do something that they wanted to do that was different than their current job somewhere else, they would probably stay with us because it's a really nice feeling to be able to wake up every day and want to go to work. And I think for a lot of people, that's not the case.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And it's hard, very hard to put a price on that, you know, so that's definitely something that attracts people to you, I think. In talking about this, it sounds like as you mentioned, you have very procedural type, you know, processes that are set up to deal with certain issues as they arise, and like you vote new policies in if you need them, and it's just a very pragmatic sort of approach. I guess my question initially, when sort of learning of it, before I knew more, was how do you avoid the problem of like design by committee, you know, where basically everybody's got a vote, everybody has a say, and everybody wants their little sort of pet project to succeed. But again, I think you've already addressed that in just how, you know, pragmatic the approach is, and I guess how democratic it is, to use a word from your website. You know, you things get voted up or down, and you reach not a consensus, but I guess a majority vote, and that probably helps with just keeping things working smoothly. Right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as I said earlier, consensus is very, very difficult, and it's not something that we almost never require consensus. I think the only thing that requires consensus is hiring and changing our bylaws. Everything else is majority.
In the case of like a review, right, with an owner who also maybe a senior owner, someone who's been there for a while, I'm not sure if there is sort of a formal hierarchy or what, or if everybody's sort of equal, but who actually does the review? Are you sitting there with the sort of jury of your peers, so to speak? Or?
So we have a rotational system where one person from your department and one rotating person both review you as an individual. We have a website set up for ourselves internally that everyone has to fill out about everyone else. And it doesn't take very long. I mean, I can literally review everyone in 5 minutes, but you basically fill out this form. We have a worksheet that it flows into. The two reviewers go and take the person aside on a schedule. We usually do it over a week period, where we schedule two people or three people a day over a few days. And you'll basically find yourself sitting in a small room with two people, your peers, one from your department, one that's rotated out, and they go over a list of both the complaints and job performance reviews that your coworkers have provided. And you know, a lot of it's positive, but they always come up with at least one negative thing. They'll talk to you about the issue, and there's questions on the worksheet that enable the person being reviewed to sort of respond and ask for help, or maybe point the finger or whatever. And at the end of the review, everybody takes notes and says, okay, great. You know, see you in a quarter, and moves on. And it's not so much about the review itself. It's that we do them so frequently. People don't bottle stuff up. You know, I don't sit there and go, oh, this one guy, he does this thing that pisses me off, I'm going to talk about it in a year. We don't do that. We talk about it openly because we know that in 3 months, we're going to have to talk about it openly. It's not like people are calling you out all the time or something. I mean, I'm the manager of my department, so I will call out the other guys in my department and say, hey, you're screwing up, quit screwing up. But when it comes to patterns of behavior, like dropping the ball, or like, you know, not showing up at a customer on time or something like that, that kind of stuff goes into these worksheets that we keep a record of and shows the improvement of the employee, but also helps us as a business adjust to that employee's habits and maybe find a good compromise. Because honestly, sometimes people aren't going to change, and you just have to work around those people's strengths. And sometimes they might do something really well and something really badly, and you can try to help them with one, but a lot, you know, you're never going to have a perfect employee. And I'm sure you guys both know this. You have to sometimes just accept people with their faults. And what's nice about the review system is it's non-confrontational. Nobody's scared. You're not going to get fired at the end of it. And it's just part of being an owner. It's not like, and also being an employee actually, but it's just not, it doesn't have that sort of sword hanging over your throat feeling that I've had at previous jobs where we had evaluations, which, you know, were almost never tied to raises, which usually were scary. And in my experience, it's a much rosier feeling on the reviewee side than at other jobs. And yeah, it is your peers. So you work with them every day. It's not like some boss you see once a month who walks through the office and scares you. It's people you talk to every single day.
Yeah, it makes me think this podcast is sort of a podcast collective, which brings me to my next point, Joe. Nice. Jerry and I want to have a review with you next week, by the way.
All right. Fair enough.
But no, I hear what you're saying, man. I really do think it's pretty I think every point that you hit upon makes sense in terms of having the boss that's kind of hanging over you, and you're reviewed by your peers, and you respect one another. And I think as long as there's no malicious intent, it all works out well for everybody involved. So I think it's an amazing idea, and it does bring a lot of thoughts to my mind about how this works, in not only concept, but how you put it into production here. If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind getting into the tech side of it as well, and kind of shifting gears a little bit and learning about how you guys operate as a technology company, and support, things like that, like what you do. Do you offer what we've always talked about here on the show, which is managed services? Do you work on an hourly schedule? How does that work with you guys?
Yeah. So I love talking about this. So we are a managed service provider. We do provide break fix services. Obviously, you'd be crazy not to do that. But most of that's project based. But most of our clients fall into one of two categories. They're on track to being a MSP client, or they are an MSP client. We try to think about things in that prism. To back up a little bit, Boston Tech Collective in particular has a lot of service offerings. My department is business support. So 95% of the time I'm working with clients that are paying us on a monthly basis to provide unlimited support within a certain framework. So to give an example, to be as technical as possible, let's say you have an office with 25 Macs and 10 PCs and 4 Linux machines and a Windows server. Okay, just like a whole bunch of crap. And you want those machines monitored for patches. You want them to receive the latest flash binary on all the Windows machines. You want the Linux machines to be to have antivirus on them. And you want to be able to call someone when anything happens ever with almost anything that might make the business stop working during the day, during regular business hours. We provide support for all of those things. And the reason I listed all of them at once is to try to describe the sort of wide berth that we cover in our service model. Most of our clients are either all Mac, all PC, or a mix. And we do have a couple clients that actually have like Linux desktops and Linux servers, and we support those as well. But all computers, before we support them, have to go through a remediation process. They have to be approved by us. We make very clear sort of what we'll support and what we don't support. And then the customers pay depending on the environment. They'll either pay a fixed fee per machine and per workstation or per server, or they'll pay us some special rate because of some unusual scenario. 95% of our clients pay us $35 a month for a Mac or a PC, and that includes antivirus. And then $60 a month for Windows servers and Linux servers. I don't think we actually have a single Mac client that has an Xserve deployed. So yeah. Anyways, in fact, our largest Mac clients are like, you know, 150 MacBooks, and they don't even have like, you know, open LDAPers, and they're just going. They don't care as long as they're file vaulted. They don't ever share anything that's not on the web. So just putting that all aside, we have sort of very clear. We have an SLA, a service level agreement, that all customers have to sign. That it's about 5 pages long. It describes in detail what we cover and what we don't. It links to somewhere another document we have that sort of gets nitty gritty about the specifics. Like, we only approve certain network hardware. If you don't have this network hardware installed, we will not cover your. We won't basically take care of any network problems you have. And so far, everyone has gone on board with that, so that's been great. And we only cover Ubiquiti and Meraki products in terms of managed networking appliances. I could go more in details if you want. I could talk about, you know, we have like Reposado and Margarita set up for Apple updates. We have a WSIS server on Amazon. We have an ESET endpoint management system in the cloud. We have a Screen Connect for remote administration. We use Watchman for monitoring. I can continue, but... whatever questions you have, I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, you definitely run the gamut of, and I like, I think what you called it was a remediation process for your computers when you're onboarding them, right? So I think that's important too. A lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, some people I've discussed this with have kind of missed that step in terms of going into the MSP model of really what we'll call the onboarding process and bringing not only the client into your system, but each device and what might be particularly wrong with it before you start managing it in the first place. And there might be some craziness. Work involved.
Craziness. Yeah. We not only require it, we charge for it. So
yeah.
The whole process for us, if you're interested, it's basically we have an initial consultation, which is always free. And we'll spend 45 minutes to an hour talking to a person either on the phone or in-house, where we'll go over what we do and what we provide. We'll ask them a whole bunch of questions. And then we'll charge them $500 to do a site audit. The site audit is exactly what it sounds like. We find out everything we can about their infrastructure from the workstation to the network level, and as well as, you know, various cloud services, backup, whatever. We'll take all this information and we'll collate it into a single site document, which we immediately share with our client. By the way, one thing we do that I think is very different is we always share site documentation with our client, not so that they can do it anything with it, but so that if they decide that they want to work with someone else down the line, they don't have to call us and have some awkward conversation about us emailing them a PDF insecurely over the internet that contains their relevant network infrastructure information. Like we always provide site documentation securely over the web. Moving forward, we would then write up a proposal and we would send them an invoice for the site audit plus a proposal and the site doc. The proposal basically explains what we think is wrong with their systems, how we think we can resolve those issues. Anything that they may have asked us to do that they brought us in for, we can try to address there. We give them an idea of how long it will take, how much it will cost, what to expect down the line, and then other suggestions that might improve things that we didn't even cover. They get this proposal. They ruminate on it, and then they get back to us and they either say yes or they say no. If they say yes, we execute the proposal and get them up to a certain stage wherein we are able to remediate. People are never ready for remediation. They always require something. So the proposal stage is almost always necessary. If for some reason they didn't need anything, we could skip the proposal stage and just go right to remediation, which is basically where we make sure that every Mac and PC and occasionally Linux box is within the auspices of our service framework. So for instance, I'm not going to support Windows XP. If Windows XP exists, or if you're on a machine older than Yosemite, I will not support your machine. It's not going to be secure. It's not going to be stable. It probably has an old hard drive. On that note, we also test every hard drive in the office. We like look for smart attributes to see if it's in some kind of pre-fail stage. If we'd identify problems that will prevent us from remediating a machine, we tell the client, and then we tell the client how much it's going to cost to fix it. Assuming everything is where it needs to be and we can clean it all up, we charge people $100 to remediate, and we have a special script that we run that prepares the machine to be monitored and patched by us remotely. By the way, we also use Monkey for management on the Mac side. It's not always necessary, but we'll deploy things through Monkey if it's necessary. And then in the end, they're onboarded and they pay us a flat fee per workstation per month. And it's month to month. We don't require some long-term contracts. And we have, I think only, since we started, we've only had one client stop being a maintenance client of ours. And they still are a regular client. They just felt like they didn't need us to maintain their machines anymore. But it's a very effective solution that once people are on, they pretty much never leave. And that's sort of how it works. Is that too specific?
No, it's very, very impressive. It's a great overview. I'm looking at on the site, and if anybody's interested, listeners can check out techcollective.com. Assume you sort of don't do much residential, at least not with managed service. It's more so geared toward businesses. Do you have any residential clients, you know, on a sort of a break fix or hourly model?
So that's a great question. As of January 1st, 2017, we no longer offer residential support at all. We had a full-time residential person who switched to business. 3 years we did residential. From our perspective, it was too difficult to find technicians in the Boston area who had our skill level requirements and were willing to work with residential. You know, not to make a pejorative out of it, but residential customers are a big pain in the ass for not much money. Look, if it's some person who wants an Airport Extreme and printer set up, that's great. I have no problem with that. But when you have someone running, you know, Windows XP with Outlook 2007 and a 20 gigabyte PST, and they lost their password to Hotmail and now they need you to fix it, it's never going to be worth the money and they'll never pay it anyways. So from our experience, and I'm trying to be as candid as possible, residential support is a big pain in the ass for not much money, and even more so, the people who are good at doing it don't want to do it for what we can pay. You know, if we're paying you $25 an hour to help old ladies work on getting AOL to work, generally people don't want to do that. I don't want to do it, you know? So long story short, we closed residential since we literally could not find a single person up to our skill level. The gentleman I mentioned earlier who we let go after a year was our attempt to do that. We had a full-time residential guy who switched over to business support slowly we hired a new residential person after basically being like, okay, well, this guy seems like he has the skills and he's nice enough, et cetera. Our experience with that and in the past taught us that residential is almost impossible to actually make good money out of unless you're really screwing people over, which I don't want to do. I don't want to be gig squad, you know?
That's been my business model for 12 years now.
I'm talking about spending 3 hours on something that would take any competent tech an hour and a half every single time. And then I'm not saying we won't do it in the future, but we won't do it until we find a competent tech who will do it.
It's really market-based because, you know, in all honesty, I mean, my business is largely residential in addition to small business. But you know, I'm one of the few that I think serves the residential market. And it's because in this market, the residential clients are willing to pay the rates to whatever degree. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you can easily get into like things that just take way longer than is reasonable to charge for. And so somebody's going to end up holding the bill at the end. And it's usually us. You know, we're usually capping labor and capping charges and crediting, you know, like for long onsites and things like that. It just doesn't pay past a certain point. But for the clients that are willing to pay it, you know, obviously the money is the same, whether it's business or residential. But I'm real curious. So you mentioned like specific skill sets and things like that. You just couldn't find someone. How would you define, you know, those skills that are uniquely suited to the residential market in a technician?
So I'll answer that question. But let me also add that we don't just look for the sort of regular assortment of skills. We also look for ownership level capability. It makes it a degree harder than hiring, both because the prospect of ownership, while it does sound enticing, often does put people off. It's hard to find, and it does require training and long time investment in a person. So we're a bit more hesitant, I think, than other companies might be, and that may be a failure in the model. I don't know. For residential support, and look, this is not my area of expertise, so I may not be able to speak intelligently on it. Having excellent social skills, having the patience and wherewithal to deal with bandaged together solutions in home environments that may be not only difficult to fix with, okay, I should back up a little bit. And one thing we often see in home environments is out-of-date routers, okay? Like people will go in Staples and they'll buy a freaking Linksys, right? Mm-hmm. And then they'll never update it for 3 years. Or they'll get Comcast and Comcast will give them some shitty SMC that drops packets 60% of the time. And when we go into an environment, we have to not only have, you know, decent networking skills, but also understand that the environment you're entering in has years of neglect. And that means like, oh, well, yeah, sure, you're on OS X 10.8 and you need some kind of software to back up your system. Oh, but Backblaze doesn't run on 10.8. So we have to first upgrade you to this, or you can use Carbonite, but it costs more and you want to complain about that. Or you saw that we supported this other product. You know, you run into the same kind of neglect you run into in the business environment, but with an even greater hesitancy to pay for those things. You have to have a technician who not only can listen, but can also sell. And sell to people who legitimately need the services. They just don't fully understand it, and often don't want to understand it. They openly say, "Oh, I don't know anything about computers." Like it's some kind of like it's a good thing. They say that it's the only thing in the world I've seen people be proud of not knowing. I don't go to the auto mechanic and say, "Well, I don't know anything about cars." Ha ha ha. So the skill sets I would say are they're in the technical. They're in the reliability sector. Like we actually have a matrix of skills that I don't have in front of me, but it's basically technical capacity, personality, ownership material, diagnostics. I'm trying to think. I haven't looked at it since we last hired, but we have a whole matrix of skills that we actually assign people points on when we hire them or when we interview them. And it helps us make decisions because there are situations where we might have two finalists and one is everything we want, but has no interest in the co-op, and the other one has no skills, but has all the personality and is trainable and loves the co-op concept. And of those two, we might be like, you know, hemming and hawing, who should we hire? But when we look at the matrix and we see how much we weigh something like personality, then it helps us make the decision. And we've done that, by the way, that specific description, that's happened twice. And in both times, it's worked out phenomenally. Because we were able to train someone. You can't train someone to have a better personality, but you can take someone with a good personality and train them to have the skills you need some of the time. That's sort of how we've done it. Again, I can't speak too much on residential. Like, I'm sure my coworker Charlie, when he listens to this, will be ringing his ears because I'm sure there's some silver bullet that he looks for when he's hiring for residential. But that's the gist of how I understand hiring to be, and I think it applies to residential as well.
I think that's very insightful, and those are some of the ideal qualities for sure. that matrix sounds very interesting. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but would that be something you'd be willing to share in some form, maybe censored or sanitized in some way? Or
I mean, I would be fine with it. I'll have to ask my coworkers to see how comfortable they are with it. But I'll ask them about it. If they're okay with it, I will send you a sanitized version. It's a good way of putting it. Okay. I'm also happy, by the way, to share our evaluations document, which I think is very good. I only wrote half of it. The other half I stole from someone else, but it's a good evaluation sort of worksheet. If you're interested, that thing I'll make public.
I mean, I think that would be great for listeners to be able to see that and just help them think about how you guys work and just gel this a little bit more in their minds and have that material to refer to. As we wrap up, I wanted to ask one more question just about the sort of pricing structure. Through talking to you, through looking at the site, it's very clear you guys are big fans of flat rate pricing wherever possible. Did you want to speak at all about why that is and whether that's the case and sort of why you landed on that, just specifically for like the shop pricing, which listeners can find on your site?
The shop I can talk about fairly intelligently because I helped design the prices there. When we first started in Tech Collective in San Francisco, I worked all over. And then when I came here, I trained people to work in the shop before switching the business 2 years ago. The prices for the shop were determined based on averages and average time and average costs to perform those tasks. And we have automated the process to such an extent that although there's a lot of critical thinking that goes into the overall process, it doesn't take much effort on the shop person's side. So we're at a point now where we actually make money hand over fist using these flat rate prices. When if I had to call a customer and say, oh, it's going to take 4 hours to do your screen repair, and then another customer I would call and tell them, oh, it's going to take 3 hours. Both of those customers had to leave our shop without knowing the price of what we were going to do, and also had to, and also receive two different prices for the same work. What we do now is we try to eliminate all variables and, using our average pricing mechanism, tell people exactly what they will pay for before we do the work. And you can only do that with flat rate pricing. So for instance, let's say you had a 2-year-old Windows PC that was infected and you brought it into us because it was doing some the tech in the front office would immediately diagnose. We diagnose every machine that comes in, and we do two things during a diagnostic. We test the hard drive of every single computer using a smart testing utility, either using a Linux bootable distro or by doing a Mac or Windows app, depending on what we can do. We test the hard drive in the machine, and we also diagnose everything else about the machine. What else is wrong that the customer might not have noticed? From that 5 to 10 minute interaction, we can tell the customer before they leave, most of the time, we can tell them, this is what it's going to cost you. And it does not vary from that. If it's going to vary, if we come onto another issue, we see that it's going to cost a lot more, we stop the work, we call the customer, and we say, here's what it's going to cost. And we always explain that if that happens and they don't go ahead with the work, we just charge a flat diagnostic fee, which I think is $80 now. The reason I mentioned smart testing of the hard drives is because no one does this. Nobody tests hard drives. And I would say it's about 60% of the quote-unquote boot issues that Windows and Mac machines have that are brought into our shop are hard drive related. Mm-hmm. And we have now automated the process of taking an image of a drive, dealing with bad sectors, getting the drive to boot on the new machine. We've automated that to the point that we charge $200 plus the cost of the drive. And we can tell that to a customer on the spot. They can understand exactly what they're getting. And generally, we can sell them on an SSD, which is even better, both for us and also for them. Mm-hmm. So for us, the flat rate pricing model works because it allows us to categorize every single kind of work that we get and make sure that not only are we not wasting time, but the customer knows exactly what they're going to pay. And if you look at our Yelp page, we have like 45 five-star reviews. And that's the reason, is because people hate not knowing what to expect. And I always tell people the difference between our company and others, we strive to manage expectations at every step of the way. So you are never surprised as an end user, because end users hate surprises. And sometimes it means I have to give a higher price estimate than I think on the business side. Like, I might go into an environment and say, I don't know how long this is going to take. I will guess double whatever my gut tells me, So sometimes you do have to do that. But on the shop side, you don't have to guess, because everything is categorizable. If it's a screen replacement, we might not know the cost of the screen yet, but we can diagnose the kind of work it will require. And by the way, this only works if you have highly trained staff. I mean, even guys who start with us, or girls who start with us, even if they've had experience elsewhere, they don't do things the way that we do things. And I'm not trying to say how great we are. I'm saying we literally work differently than other businesses. We do this sort of critically thinking sort of diagnostic that no one else does. I've never known another company that smart tests every computer that comes in. And for us, that's really helpful, because if you bring a machine in that has a virus and we smart test the hard drive, or if you bring a computer in that has a broken screen that's 2 years old and the hard drive is failing, you might not want to put all the work in, because now you have this extra thing that, hey, you remove the virus, but a month later my screen is blue, or 2 weeks later my screen is damaged, or the machine's not booting, or whatever. We like people to know everything that's wrong about their machine before they leave it with us, so that we can manage their expectations. And yeah, sometimes it means that we tell people you shouldn't pay to fix this machine, but it's right. The honesty still transforms into work down the line. And for us, customer service is key. And we waste money sometimes. We spend more time on something that doesn't give us a return. But to me, the satisfaction the customer gets from whatever level of service we provide always has them not only return, but tell their friends. If you look at the San Francisco Tech Collective, which is based on the same philosophy, I haven't checked this recently, but at one point, and it's possibly still, we were the highest rated IT company in the country on Yelp for what we did. Like in terms of the total number of 5 stars. They actually asked me to come to some symposium once in San Francisco years ago to talk about how we succeeded on Yelp. And I went, and basically all I said, which is what everyone else said, was you just prioritize customer expectations and you deliver the best possible customer service and you remind them to review you, and it all works out. And that's sort of the key to me of providing excellent customer service with a guaranteed return, is always, always manage customer expectations. And the only way to do that is to spend a little bit extra time categorizing job types and flat rate pricing so that customers get the total value for their dollar.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think the flat rate pricing obviously goes a long way toward managing the expectations, because you can just give them a number and they have that number in their head, and it's not a multiple of an hourly rate, and it's not some, you know, unknown range of time or anything like that. It's just a very specific number that they can walk away with. And that's something that's very comforting, I think, especially when they're probably worried, if they don't know you yet, what the outcome is going to be. When they bring their computer in, they have a number in their head, like it's going to cost probably at least $100 and maybe several hundred. They just don't know what, you know, what's wrong. And you're able to just exactly put a number on it. And that's probably very comforting in that sense. One sort of counterpoint to it, it just occurs to me, like when you very clearly define an issue, like we're going to replace your hard drive, and you do get in there and you find that there's a lot of like launch agents that need to be cleaned up, and you know, maybe there are viruses and things like that, and you have separate fees for those things, you know, the technician then has to sort of, if this hasn't come out in diagnostics for whatever reason, has to then stop work and call the client and renegotiate and stuff like that. Whereas if you have multiple of an hourly rate and you've given them a range, like, you know, 60 to 90 minutes or something like that, if it's more than you expected, you know, you charge them on the high end of that. If it just goes very smoothly, you charge them on the low end, and sort of makes it a little bit easier to just jump in and do some work without having to have a full, you know, diagnostic session to learn exactly what's wrong. But on the other hand, I completely agree with you. Running the hardware test on the hard drive, we do the same thing for every machine that comes through. For the same reason. I mean, we may not replace the screen if the drive is failing, or we may say, well, you know, you've got to also go ahead with an SSD, or at least replace the drive, or you're not going to have, you know, much satisfaction out of this ultimately. So it's definitely a very useful thing, and it's a necessary thing, I think, these days, in the waning days of spinning drives.
Spinning drives, right. Yeah. Hey, I have SSD fails. It does happen. Smart is not going to help you with that. But yeah, I mean, that's why to me, it's all SSDs and backup, 3-2-1 backup. But I think your counterpoint is really valid, and I completely agree. The benefit of the model is that you have this control. Whenever something else happens and you just go ahead with it, there's always that voice in the back of your head saying, oh, what if they're pissed off about the work? You know, because they don't know. They don't understand. And you even brought it up. You said if they haven't worked with you before, they don't trust you. And I think you hit on the cornerstone of our industry is trust. Mm-hmm. It's basically impossible to trust anyone if you don't know anything about their industry. Like, I have no idea what car mechanic to trust. I have no idea. I have to ask someone, right? On the other hand, car mechanics, I think, have a higher barrier to entry for creating a business. To be an IT person, I'm a high school dropout with no college degree. I have no education. And yet I was able to start a business. You know, I literally put a sign up and went door to door, you know, which is just what my dad did, the same thing. You know, I think it's like an immigrant mentality, is I just went door to door and started this business. And the problem is that that's what a lot of people are doing. And the customer has no idea which person or which company is the reliable company. And they have to, you know, now they have, Yelp and Google reviews and all that crap and Angie's List, and they can look, and that makes a difference. But in my opinion, they're still not really qualified to determine what is the right company to use. Fundamentally, every new client is a battle between their distrust of you and your desire to help them. That's fundamentally why managing their expectations is so important, is because it builds that trust that is almost impossible in our industry. Well, this is, of course, my experience. I'm sure it's different for others.
No, I completely agree. I think the trust factor is like the number one thing. And that's why, you know, hiring good people who are trustworthy themselves to represent your business, and, you know, people with integrity, people who, you know, who are personable, you know, that kind of thing. I think that's, you know, it's super, super important. And once you lose the reputation, it's very hard to get it back. So I think that keeping the customer satisfaction in mind as the name of the game is probably the most important thing. So, and you clearly have that in mind, and it's been really interesting talking to you about this design of the organization and just your sort of philosophy of doing business. And I think it'll be very interesting to listeners who are not used to this business model. So I really appreciate you coming on to talk a little bit about it.
Thank you so much for having me. Obviously, I talk a lot, and I appreciate getting the chance to do that. If anyone wants to reach out to me and ask questions about co-ops or even some of the business that I talked about, you can email me at yochai@techcollective.com, yochai@techcollective.com. I'm happy to talk about co-ops with literally anybody. So if you're considering it for your own model business, I'm more than excited to talk to you about it.
Don't let anybody push you around about talking too much. It makes for a really easy interview.
That's
so
true. Makes our job easier. For sure.
Thanks for joining us, man. It was awesome. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.